Kent Nagel. This is my swan song talk in the village. It's been a privilege, big time for me to be here. And last week I talked about Islam and had been asked to talk further this week, so that's what I'm going to do now. I'm on the faculty of Concordia College in New York, and 15 miles north of the towers, twin towers that went down. And everybody in my village of Bronxville knew somebody that died in the towers. We had some alums that died in the South Tower when that went down. And it was an amazing day for us as a campus because, you know, in New York we have three major airports, and it's always the sound of planes in the air. And it was absolutely silent. Everybody grounded everything. And the only thing up was military. This was a, this really was a profound effect on the campus, and it affected our students. And we even had a funeral on our campus, which we don't do. But we had our chapel extends and can be open into a very large performance area. And Ron Buca, who was a Lutheran, died in the towers. And he was the first fire marshal in the history of New York to die in the line. And this was something else. And his home church in Queens wasn't big enough for the service. And on that day, this is image. I was pleased to help with some of the logistics of it, but it was both a military funeral and a fire department funeral because he was in special forces and from time to time would go overseas and do things that were not talked about. I mean, he's a warrior, and then would come back, but he was also marshal in the city. And so at the funeral, there were 300 New York Fire Department taking the salute lined up, and then they had state police and EMT folk from all around. It was amazing. And then there were also people from the U.S. Army honoring him as well. And it was really kind of weird because coming into the foyer, well, the narthex, I guess, to our chapel, the military had stacked their M16s. And we don't have weapons on campus at all. I mean, in New York, we don't have weapons. And so this was a shock. Obviously, they were ceremonial weapons, but it was a shock. This is still, again, we know people in the towers that went down, and we're around that 10-year anniversary, so we should look at where this happened and how can it be that a bunch of Saudi Arabians threw planes into towers and killed 3,000 people. So actually, the death count could have been grotesquely higher, and it was actually 10 years before 9/11 that you may remember that the blind sheik orchestrated another bombing of the World Trade, and about 23, 24 people were killed in that, and a lot of the bugs got worked out of the radio systems and evacuation systems, so the evacuation went really, really, really well. And 30 plus thousand people got out of the towers. 30,000 people got out. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on that, but I want to dwell on the question of how did we get here? How did we get here? And I want to quote something from Tom Friedman, who's one of the few journalists that actually is credible to me and knows what he's talking about. He's lived in the Middle East. He's lived in Amman. He has Egyptian friends. He's also a globalist and talks about today more than ever the traditional boundaries between politics, culture, technology, finance, national security, and ecology are disappearing. You often cannot explain one without referring to the others. You cannot explain the whole without reference to them all. In a world where we are so much more interconnected, the ability to read the connections, to connect the dots, is the real value added. If you don't see the connections, you won't see the world. And we are a truly global environment, and what I do, I try and prepare international managers, and we try and prepare people to have the ability to connect the dots. Further quote, this is from the director of the Al Arabiya Network in Dubai. It's Abdul Rahman Al Rashed. He's the director in Dubai. And he's an anti-jihadist. He's fairly moderate. And he's under a lot of criticism. But he wrote that not all Muslims are terrorists, but it is equally certain and exceptionally painful that most terrorists are Muslim. Okay. There's a hell of an indictment on your own people. So let's look at sort of a big picture. There are about 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. Only about 12% are Arabs. Okay. And what is the most populous Muslim country?
Indonesia.
Okay. It's 243 million. It's the fourth most populous country. It's not their faith, their Islam is not radical. You can go north to Malaysia. It's not radical. The largest Arab state in the Middle East is Egypt. It's Egypt, 80 million people. Okay. Saudi Arabia has about 26 million folks. About 5.5 of those are foreign workers. Interestingly, that in our own community, we seem in the United States to have done it because we're pretty good. Even though we're being silly, in Arizona, we're pretty good with immigrant populations, and the Muslims, Bosnian Muslims and all kinds of folks that are coming to the United States are joining this society. And majority of Arab Americans are Christian; they're not Muslim. I want to go back to something that Osama bin Laden said in 2001. And he said, we no longer can stand where we are today after 80 years of humiliation. Okay, so what on earth is Osama bin Laden talking about? And the bin Laden family is a hugely wealthy company, family and company in Saudi. Big construction company, but they are from Yemen. The bin Laden family is from Yemen, and time permitting, we'll talk about Yemen yet a bit tonight. Okay, Islam developed in the 7th century, and the visions of Muhammad began in 610 AD, and became revelations known as the Quran. Okay, that's the sort of foundation of Islam, obviously. Islam was a expansionist religion, and we all know through Northern Africa and the Moors going up into Spain, right? Charles Martel, Song of Roland, all those kinds of things. Also, from the other side coming with the Ottoman Turks, and they came all the way. The Ottoman Turks were kind of a remarkable empire. They had several of them. And they came up through Europe, through Budapest, and ruled Budapest actually quite well, and came all the way to Vienna, and to the gates of Vienna were held by the Ottoman Turk. And in 1683, there was a very famous battle at the gates of Vienna, and the Muslims lost that battle. And the sweep of the Ottoman Turks was halted, and there's famous artwork and on that. Interestingly, the date of that battle was September 11th. And several scholars and commentators have said, and it's a little simplistic, I think, but they say, since then, Islam has not found a way to reconcile with the modern world. Okay, let's go back to Osama bin Laden saying 80 years ago, this was in 2000, 80 years prior to 2000. Since 80 years, they've been humiliated. So let's go back 80 years. And what happened 80 years before 2000? End of World War I, right, 1915, okay, which was supposed to be the war to end all wars, the Great War. And the Ottoman Empire was defeated. Okay, and hopefully you've seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia. That's the era. Okay. They were defeated. And the Ottoman Empire went throughout the Middle East, okay, not just where Turkey is today, went through all Palestine, went through Iraq, all the Lebanon, Syria, all the way down into the Arabian Peninsula, all the way down to the holy cities, you know, to Jeddah, Mecca, and Medina. So the Ottoman Empire was really huge throughout the Middle East and had been for centuries. The Ottomans were actually fairly beneficial. That's a bad word. They were pretty intelligent rulers in the sense that they did not debase the people that they conquered, and they did not mandate that you had to become Muslim. You could be a Christian, you could be a Jew, and that would be fine. In fact, I mentioned Budapest. There's a grave in the castle, for those of you who've been there, in Buda, above the Danube. And it's the grave of one of the governors, one of the Turkish governors of Budapest. And it says, in German, it says, leave these bones at peace. This was a good man. Okay. This is the occupier. So, but anyway, the Ottoman Empire is gone. The Muslim rule in the Middle East was defeated, and a vacuum ensued, and the Ottomans, showing a poor sense of judgment, had allied themselves with Germany and Austro-Hungary. They lost. The states that they had been administering, there was a power vacuum. All the administrators and army pulled back into Asia Minor, into modern-day Turkey. And then the League of Nations, which is a precursor to the UN, granted British and French, to the victors, but to British and French administration of the Ottoman provinces south of modern-day Turkey. And these were known as mandates. Okay, so Iraq, Syria, the Lebanon, Transjordan, Palestine were then, those were all mandates run by the French or by the Brits. Okay. This is a pretty horrendous change for those in those countries. They are no longer ruled by Muslims. They are being administered by overseas foreigners. And their great legacy is over. And the legacy in the Middle East intellectually is vast. The great library of Alexandria, okay, Euclidean geometry came out of Alexandria. Okay, this is not just donkeys and stuff. I mean, this is serious medicine, serious astronomy, and really, you know, a way of life and supported by God, by Islam, and it was defeated. Their way of life failed. And many reasons for that, poor leadership, I mean, terrible leadership, but that failed.
I had a question.
Sure.
The U.S. just backed out, now, because obviously they were big victims here. The U.S. just ceded that to Britain.
The U.S. was not a significant global power in 1918. Americans like, well, you know, Americans came to help finish the war off in Europe. But they, the U.S. was not a European power, was not a Middle East power, was not a global power. The great empires really were, you know, the Brits. The British Empire was still, you know, paint the map red. The sun did not set on the British Empire. So this is really before the American century. It's a good question, but this is before the American century. Okay. Yeah.
I do know, I mean, I come from Greek heritage. Greeks would say a very different story about the Ottoman Empire and the building of mosques on top of
right.
Orthodox churches and the affront that that was in that occupation.
I I'm coming at this from a broad stroke. I mean, I have friends from Albania and Macedonia that would absolutely agree with you, but I'm trying to do this yeah. broad stroke. There are imperial powers, let's say the Japanese, that are in no way benign. I don't want to get, we're going to get far afield, so I'm going to try and stay on track. So, again, there may well be, and there probably should be, disagreement with some things of what I'm saying. I'm trying to be balanced. I'm trying to give a sweep of history, and we'll continue on there.
One other quick question.
Sure.
Why did Belgians stay out of the Middle East? Because they also had a significant number of holdings, and they were able to move into Africa over that time interval. Why did they stay out of the Middle
East? Well, Belgium was an imperial power but Belgian experience in Africa, Belgium kind of got the leftovers.
Yeah.
And you know, Belgian Congo was horrific. I mean, it was a bad thing. They were not a global power the way France and the Brits were. So, speaking of Greece, let's go to somebody who was born in Greece. His name is Ataturk. But he was a modernist, and in 1919 was the head of Turkey, and he turned Turkey, which, you know, what had been Ottoman, and from the past. And Ataturk said, let's learn from the West, okay? The system that we had, the Ottoman Empire that we had, it was not sustainable, it imploded, it was way too corrupt, it wasn't efficient, our technology was lacking, we need to modernize, okay? And this is, I think, quite similar to the Meiji Restoration in the 1868, I think it was, in Japan, where Japan said, all right, we don't want to be put upon by any other Western powers anymore. We are going to become a modern country. We're going to educate our people. We're going to have technology. Okay. And remember in that when the Russians sent their fleet around to teach the Japanese a lesson, I think it was 1902 or 1905, the Japanese sunk the Russian fleet. Okay, absolutely not possible from the European perspective. Changed the whole gravity, the whole balance of power in the world. So, This was a sea change in the Middle East when Ataturk changed Turkey. And he made Turkey a secular republic. People are still Muslim there, but it's a secular republic. And he said, we're going to have equality for women. We've been wasting half of our intellectual capital. We're going to have equality for women. He displaced Sharia law, and we'll talk about Sharia law later. And in 1924, he abolished the caliphate. The caliphate is called the caliph is the successor to the prophet. And the caliphate is quasi-religious rule. So that you're bonding together, almost a theocracy, when you have the caliphate. And Ataturk said, we're not going to go down that road anymore. We're just going to have a secular republic. And equality for women, what a shock, you know, in the Middle East. It's amazing. Is that going to happen in Saudi Arabia? No. Not in my lifetime. Probably not in my son's lifetime. When I was rolling around a lot in the 1990s in Turkey, they had a woman prime minister called Şiler. Okay. That is so radical. Ataturk outside of Turkey is burned today regularly in effigy, okay, especially by the Muslim Brotherhood, because this was such a profound and radical turning from the traditions that had been building up in conservative world.
Kid, I would add also that came very soon after women's suffrage in the United States.
I think, I think Ataturk is probably, I mean, I'm a business person, but I think as far as the 20th century in that region, I think he's the most profoundly radical individual. I mean, just amazing. He also changed the language, okay? And so instead of writing in Turkish in Arabic, okay, characters, it's now in Western characters, okay? So everyone in this room, you may not understand it, but you could read Turkish, okay? And he did it in a generation. And so education for boys and girls immediately, and also he changed the language. And I kind of joke around, wouldn't it be interesting if the U.S. government said, okay, by next Thursday, all you people have to start writing in Cyrillic, like Russian Cyrillic. Okay, everybody good with that? Yeah. Fine with me. Again, we're trying to do a sweep of history here. We got 1920s, the House of Saud, and conservative clerics on the Arabian Peninsula. Ibn Saud, the patriarch, formed the country in 1932, and to tie the diverse tribes together and the diverse religious interests together, he gave various ministries of government to different segments of society. And this is a profound hinge event. It sounds modest, but you'll see where I'm going in the history of the Middle East, because and one of the speakers that I have come to talk to Concordia is an expert in Sharia law, Mike McMillan, who right now is working in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, on Sharia compliant finance. Under Sharia law, you can't charge interest, and you also cannot have a mortgage. So how are you gonna do finance? You can't charge interest. You can't have a mortgage. You got to pledge something. No, you can't. But he's also a scholar of the Quran, and he found some texts that were accepted by some Egyptian scholars in the Quran, whereby if someone lent someone else resources or goods to go trading, and that person never came back, then the person that made the loan of those goods should give their camel. The person who lost the stuff should return his camel to the family of the family who made the loan. Okay, so it's sort of a mortgage. Okay. So now it's actually from small things like that. There was now we're talking $1 billion in finance can happen. Not just in Saudi, but in Indonesia and Malaysia with Sharia compliance. Because in many Muslim countries, legal systems, they have really Sharia law to a certain extent becomes part of civil law. Okay. But this twist of fate that happened is that Ibn Saud in the 1930s, when he was dividing up the ministries, he gave the Ministry of Education, okay, and there was no education in the Arabian Peninsula, so this was like an empty thing. There weren't schools, no one could read, it was society. He gave the Ministry of Education to the Wahhabis, okay, and these are the followers of a chap called Abdul Wahhab. This is 200 years prior to the century. And this began as a cleansing reform movement 200 years ago to rid Islamic societies of evolved cultural practices and interpretations that had developed, but the Wahhabis don't think are pure. So, now, fast forward to 1970s when you had the oil shock and there's more money rolling into Saudi Arabia than the Saudis actually need to. It's called the boom, and they knew what to do with it. Okay. But they have all these funds now for education. Okay. So who's funding education and who's managing education? Wahhabism. Okay. And so the madrasas in Pakistan, the madrasas in Sudan, okay, who's funding that stuff? And I think we ought to be really, really careful in the United States to say who's funding the madrasas or the school mosques in the United States or France or whatever. Because this is not mainstream Islam. Remember, only 12% of Muslims are Arabs, and this is a little piece of that within Saudi Arabia. Okay. In addition to sort of cutting a deal for legitimacy, the House of Saud, to be legitimate, they needed the blessing of the clerics, and so they bought off the clerics and gave them a lot of money, and they gave them ministries and so forth. And also, walk around Saudi today, I've been to Saudi a fair bit, and there are these notorious cane-wielding, they're called Mutawa, and they are called the morality police. Okay, and if a woman is showing legs, if a woman is showing too much skin, if a woman is not properly covered, they will whip her right there. If they're really angry, they will arrest you. And one thing that in Saudi Arabia, there are two legal systems. One is a secular legal system, and another is a religious legal system. If you get caught up in the secular one, you're going to be okay. You know that you'll go to court, they may throw you out of the country, you may pay a fine. If you get caught up in the religious system, you don't know how it's going to end up. You may just disappear. Okay. And a number of times when I was there, the Saudis that I was with, and I was also with a lot of Palestinians in Saudi, they were made very careful that I did not cross any lines or misbehave. They did this out of friendship, because if I would get caught up in the Mutawa and arrested, nobody could help it. U.S. Embassy, that's a joke, right? They couldn't help me either. So this is very real. I should say, too, that we've got 26 million folk living in Saudi Arabia, 5-6 million of those are foreign workers, foreign workers. And the folks that I worked with were engineers, highly trained engineers, and they were Palestinian. Okay. And as Greta talked earlier today, and we're going to potentially kind of overlap with a couple things, but my Israeli friends will say that the Palestinians are the elite of the Arab world. They are the most educated, and that's true. And they are very good at business. And so the Palestinian ethnic Palestinians working in Jordan or working in Egypt are very, very high station in society. They're truly good managers, they're very good business folk. And the head of Mercedes-Benz in Saudi Arabia is a Palestinian. Okay. And the Saudis don't like the Palestinians. But anyway, so interesting in Saudi, where you have so many different nationalities of guest workers. And if you're a high-end professional, they may let you in if you're Palestinian. But they don't want to hire the Palestinians in the, let's say, in Gaza or the camps. They don't want the trouble. Okay. So they will bringing people from Bangladesh, they're bringing people from the Philippines, they're bringing people from Pakistan, but they won't bring in people from Gaza.
Yeah. I think they're not considered Palestinian. They're not considered immigrants. Palestinian.
I would. I'll defer to Greta, but I would say yes. Well, yes, they are. I would absolutely say the Iranians are not Arabs. The Iranians are and they will correct you very quickly. They're Persians, and that's another ancient society. Okay, I need to keep moving along. So we've got this seed sown right in the 1930s with. Radical, virulent, ultra-Orthodox Wahhabism in the kingdom, almost by accident. During then, between the wars, Egypt developed an anti-colonial rhetoric, and during this time there was the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, you've heard of that, and that is the precursor to Al-Qaeda. During the pre-war years, many Arab states allied themselves with the fascists in Europe. And I'll just throw that out. And then after World War II, moving forward, Middle East states gained independence. The UK gave up the mandate of Palestine, which was partitioned by the UN into Arab and Jewish states. I thought it was very interesting that the maps that Greta put up today showed the first proposal of by the UN on how that was going to be partitioned into two states. And the Israelis today will say that if the Arabs had accepted that first map, they would not have survived as a country. Because the way that map was drawn, to have a country, a non-contiguous country, was non-tenable. Okay, so it was, looking back over history, the Israelis are relieved that the Arabs didn't accept the lines drawn of the UN partition. Anyway, Israel was seen as a colonial outpost at the time, in position by the West. Into Palestine, what is this? This is you're putting a country of Europeans in, who don't belong in our midst, and so this was seen as a colonial outpost, and the Arab states refused to accept this. Then we'll go to 1948, where the five nations of Egypt, right, most populous Arab state, Syria, Transjordan, Lebanon, and Iraq, made war on little Israel. Israel had about 500,000 people who could fight back. So you had these major Arab states attacking Israel, and they're going to push the Israelis into the sea. And this is sort of it's an amazing achievement that the Israelis held, and has really reflects kind of the mystique that Israel has built up. But, you know, when you've got nowhere to go, you're back, you know, Israel is basically a beach, you know. When you've got nowhere to go, you're going to fight really hard. And they fought really hard. And the Israelis call it their war of liberation. The Arabs call it Al-Nakba, which is the catastrophe, right? So how could it be that these five major Arab states, Muslim states, right, how could they possibly lose? Okay, so we're going back to Osama bin Laden, right? We're going to the humiliation, but here's a further humiliation, that this was a catastrophe. After this catastrophe, there's a colonel in Egypt called Nasser, and he led a coup. He talked about justice through socialism and land reform. And he allied himself initially with the Muslim Brotherhood, but then he allied himself further with the Soviets, okay? And the Soviets are infidels, right? They're communists, they're not people of the book, you know? Christians are these people of the book. Okay, so Nasser is aligning himself with infidel, all right? And then NASA further jails and turns on the Muslim Brotherhood as they start opposing him. Soviets funded the Aswan Dam, big deal, and still to this day. And the U.S. Was trying to play some kind of role here and gave some foreign aid to Egypt. And as a point of insulting the United States, Nasser took that money and he built a mosque in downtown Cairo. Okay. And today you can go see that mosque. And the taxi drivers will laugh and say, "Damn, taxpayers in Iowa paid for that mosque." That's funny. And it was a point of contention. Interesting, too, there was a time when NASA nationalized the Suez Canal, a major canal, and this was run and really controlled by the Brits. And the Brits were sending in troops and along with Israelis to retake the canal. This was 1956. And Eisenhower parked a U.S. carrier off of Alexandria and said, "Brits, go home. Israelis, go back." Okay, and so the U.S. had a fairly good reputation at the time, and this really marked the end of when the Brits had to back off from the Suez Canal, which was like they had by divine right, at least they thought they had. That was truly, really the end of empire. You know, they kind of pretended they had empire for a long time, but when the Americans said, you know, "You now have to go home," that was truly the end of empire. Mm-hmm. So getting back to NASA, NASA jailed many of the Muslim Brotherhood. So big issues, domestic strife in many of the countries, this disbelief that this, you know, the grand traditions, how could they be failing? You know, they had this great history of medicine, great history of empire and medicine, and this fake. And so in 1967, my editorial, "To Divert Domestic Unrest, Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Joined by Jordan, Tried to Destroy Israel." And this was the Six-Day War in 1967. It was another humiliation, and Israel took over the West Bank. They took over Gaza, which had been ruled by Egypt, and they went through Jerusalem. Okay. Jerusalem's one of the three holy cities of Islam. Humiliation, humiliation, humiliation. This was such an embarrassment that then the people in the street couldn't believe that they were being so poorly led. I mean, you had to blame someone. There's no way that we could keep losing because we have these great traditions. And so in Libya, you have a colonel called Gaddafi come to power. In Iraq, you had Hussein, our late friend. And then in Syria, you had Assad Syria come to power. So very, very authoritarian folk come to power where it had not been that authoritarian in the past. And all these regimes were very oppressive on women as well. Additionally, they're saying that in much of many Arab or Muslim countries, there were Christian minorities and there were Jewish minorities that lived decently with their neighbors. And today, you know, Christians are getting squeezed out of the Middle East. Jewish communities are getting squeezed out of the Middle East. I have an adjunct law professor at Concordia, teaches business law. He's an excellent lawyer, a Jewish lawyer. His family comes from where? Baghdad. Can't go back. Interestingly, Turkey is an Islamic state, but it is a secular state, and is proud of their Jewish community in Istanbul. As a society, they are proud that they have that support and that diversity. And Turkey is a great bridge, I think, to the various stans in the former Soviet Union, but also to the Middle East. And the work that I, you know, business work I did in Turkey just thoroughly impressed me. They make very sophisticated machine tools, CAD-assisted design. They make parts for Boeing, okay? So this is not donkeys and sheep anymore, right? This is a serious country, and very high level of education, very sophisticated economy. And the other Arab states are still burning Atatürk in effigy for making a modern, viable Arab Muslim country. Okay. Then we got into the 1970s. I mentioned this before, the rise of oil production, the oil shock. But then we get into economic stagnation in the Arab states, let's say Kuwait, especially Saudi, because there's no need to modernize society. Okay. Look around the world. Countries without resources are the ones with the higher standard of living. The countries with oil, except for our friends the Norwegians, are all screwed up. Okay? You look at Hugo Chavez, right, in Venezuela, driving that country into the ground. You look at Saudi, you look at Kuwait, you can look at the Emirates. And you don't have to invest in your country. Those countries without natural resources invest in their people, in their education. So you look at Switzerland. What does Switzerland have? It's got nothing. It's got rocks. Okay, what has Japan got? Japan's got nothing. Japan's got rocks. Okay, what does Singapore have? Singapore's got nothing. They got a swamp. Okay? But they have these standards of living, incredible societies, incredible focus on education, and they live by their wits. Okay? Very high level of sophisticated technology, very sophisticated finance, right? People have to think on their feet. In a resource-rich country like Iraq or Saudi, you stick a pipe in the ground, stuff just comes out, okay? And you sit around, and you hire foreigners to run your country for you. So, here we are in the 70s, stagnation in the societies. The dictators allied themselves with extremist clerics to contain dissent. Again, we're back to Wahhabism. And under Wahhabism, all reformers and modernization, and those that are pushing for modernization, all those people are legitimate targets of violent jihad. You try and modernize society or reform anything, you are a legitimate target of violent jihad, okay? And these are the folks that are funding and the globalization of Wahhabi Islam. And to quote again Tom Friedman, we in the United States, we're funding both sides of the war on terror, okay? We're funding the Israelis we're funding the Saudis with all our money for the oil, and that money is going to the Wahhabis, and that Wahhabis are doing violent jihad around the world. And just as an aside, a number of studies have shown if we could, as a society, get to 46 miles per gallon on a CAFE standard, corporate average fuel efficiency for our country, you know, we don't need to drive, you know, huge SUVs, Yukons. We don't need Arnold, what's that thing he drives around in? Hummer. If we get to where Germany is today, they have a CAFE standard of 46 miles per gallon. Okay. Yes, they drive 450 SLs, but on average, they have 46 miles per gallon. So technologically, it's actually, U.S. is pretty good at technology. We could do this, we just have to decide to do it. Okay. And if we did it, okay, we would not need to import any Middle East oil. We would still import Mexican oil, Canadian oil, and Venezuela, but no Middle East oil. And would that change anything? That would change everything. I mean, I'm being way not balanced here. That would change everything. Okay? And if we could tell the Saudis to, you know, sit on the oil editorial, that would be just fine with me. And then we get back to the 70s, we get to 1973, we get to the Yom Kippur War. which is Egypt and Syria against Israel. And my Israeli folks, again, as Greta says, everybody in Israel is in the army if they're under attack. And a friend of mine is in actually intelligence in the IDF base in Tel Aviv. And he says that in the 67 war, Jordan in error came in. And in the 73 war, Jordan in error stayed out. Okay. And if Jordan had come in 73, the Syrians and the Jordanians would have reached the Golan. Okay. And at one time, during the Yom Kippur War, on the Golan, on the Golan, there was one tank between the Syrians and Tel Aviv. One tank. And the Syrians didn't know it. It was that close a thing. And if you take Golan, the Israelis will never give up Golan. There's not going to be peace in the Middle East in my lifetime, but for sure, the Israelis are not going to give up Golan. That is such a strategic, it looks over all of Northern Galilee. And it was almost breached. It was almost breached in 73. So ultimately, as we know, Israel prevailed. Okay, but there were an early string of Arab successes, and this went a long way to offset the humiliation of the Six-Day War, and this enabled Carter in 78 with Sadat and Begin to sign the Camp David Accords. Okay. Moving forward to 1979, we had the fall of the Shah, it was a U.S. ally. Khomeini came to power. He wasn't close to the Muslim Brotherhood, but he had support from the Muslim Brotherhood. And Khomeini I'm not a Quranic scholar, but has a distorted view of Islam, at least most Muslims would say so, and is looking to return Islam to its historic roots, kind of a mythical historic roots, sort of Middle Ages. And one of the things that Khomeini did, he reduced the marriage age for girls from 18 to 9. There was brutal repression, and this was when I was in graduate school at the Thunderbird School, and there were a number of Iranians there, and I don't know if you remember this, but all communication was cut off between the outside world and Iran. And on the nightly news, they would show the corpses and bodies of people who had been killed by the Revolutionary Guard. And we have a wonderful woman who is the dean of our faculty at Concordia. She's a professor of English. I was born in England, and her English is better than mine. It just bugs me. But she's a wonderful woman, and she's Iranian. And she came over before the fall of the Shah to do her PhD. But she came from a well-respected family. And a number of times on the nightly news, she saw the bodies of her family members in the morgue. She could actually identify. And the killing under Khomeini is the number of people that were killed under Khomeini is far more than under the Shah. No one's being an apologist for the Shah here. But this great revolution was nasty, and also mandated the return of the hijab, the covering. And yet, my view is that we as Americans, we are going to have a rapprochement with Iran. Ahmad Ahmadinejad is crazy, but the people of Iran are highly educated. Very sophisticated. The women in that society are lawyers, they're avocats, they're engineers, they're doctors. This is a very sophisticated society. And it's interesting that societies where the governments are rapidly anti-American, let's say like Iran, the people generally have a very positive view and actually a warm view for the United States. Mm. And the countries that we are allied with, let's say the Saudis, those citizens get in their planes and fly into New York towers. I really believe that. So we should be very careful if I can do a little sermon here. We should be very careful when you go to your communities, when people start, let's just nuke those bastards, If we play this right, we will have rapprochement. And there are many Iranians that have studied in the West, many Iranians that have gone back and forth. And again, to sort of a theme this week, when you have the sort of the gift of communication, of relationship, it's not going to get stupid. It's when you demonize the opposition, it gets stupid. And that's what the Wahhabis are doing. Anybody who wants to modernize or reform outside of our definition is going to be legitimately subject to violent jihad. We're going to kill them. Okay. Sadat, going back, the Camp David Accords was open to the West, made peace with Israel. When Egypt made peace with Israel, Egypt being the most populous Arab state, war against Israel, conventional war against Israel, is not possible without Egypt in the mix. So Sadat was much hated by the Muslim Brotherhood, and he also said, Sadat said that Khomeini was a lunatic. And then in 1981, he was assassinated. Interestingly, that he had regularly locked up Osama's aide, Ayman al-Zawahiri, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, regularly was in jail by Sadat. So what we traced here is 80 years of humiliation. And so think of the people in the street. I'm not being grand or patronizing, but in general, they're not educated, okay? And their culture has been debased, has been ruled by foreigners. A colony has been imposed in their midst, okay? They have not been well led internally. They've been on the wrong side a number of times of wars. Humiliation. We're going to strike back. We've got to push back. Okay. So that is what Bin Laden talked about for these 80 years of humiliation, and hopefully I painted sort of a coherent road from 1918, the end of the Ottomans, the end of the Caliphate, okay, to where we are today. I also want to touch very briefly on Yemen. And Yemen is the country southwest on the Arabian Peninsula. It's a very strategic country. It has a very famous port called Aden. And that's where a lot of vessels will go in to bunker, which means to refuel and refit. And Aden is where the coal was bombed in 2000. And 17 Americans were killed there. Capital is Sana'a. I was in Yemen a long time ago, but have done business with Yemenis. And it is the poorest Arab country and the least educated Arab country. And cause and effect, it is the most radical Arab country. Okay. It is becoming the new home of Al-Qaeda. There isn't a lot for the men to do there. The women do most of the work. In the afternoon, the men chew a thing called khat, K-H-A-T. It's a leaf, and the Yemenis use it to kind of relax. And so the guys sit around in the afternoon, a little pinch between cheek and gum, chewing actually a big chunk between cheek and people on both sides say, well, this is a real problem in society. but the ruling folks say, well, please, let's have them continue to chew cot because they might get then even further radicalized. Okay. Yemen's Al-Qaeda branch is headed by a chap called Al-Wukuyashi, and for 6 years was bin Laden's private secretary in Afghanistan. There is a direct line between bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in Yemen. And Wukuyashi claimed credit for the failed recent Detroit-bound Christmas Day bombing. Interestingly, again, this is bin Laden's home turf. This is where his family is. And in last year, there was a high-quality video clip on the internet with Al-Wukuyashi and two new Qaeda commanders. Interestingly, former detainees at where? Guantanamo. And actually, half the remaining detainees in Guantanamo are Yemeni. Also, Al-Qaeda has announced that it's going to merge the Saudi and Yemen branches of Al-Qaeda into a single unit. They're going to call it Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, and the ambition is to replace the infidel governments in Yemen, the president called Saleh, and the infidel government in Saudi Arabia, that's King Abdullah. So, the Saleh in Yemen and Abdullah in Saudi are very slowly in increments trying to modernize their societies. So anybody who's trying to modernize societies is what? A legitimate target of violent jihad. And in the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, they've come down really hard on Al-Qaeda. Not exactly due process, and have really come down on them. And so Al-Qaeda, as much as they, we are the great Satan, and we are supporting these folks, they're, at the end of the day, their end game is to change the ruling regimes in Saudi and Yemen. And their basic objectives, and this is in their own words, is to recruit more followers, to overthrow Saleh, and use Yemen as a base to attack the Saudi monarchy and build an Islamic caliphate, which Ataturk abolished. So this is a necessity, a very sketchy overview, but what is the road to radical Islam? And I want to repeat that 100 years ago, Islam was not radicalized. That there were Jewish and Christian communities throughout the Middle East. And no, it wasn't all wine and roses, but they accommodated, they lived with each other. And this radicalization has happened in the last 80 years. And it is a tragedy. I'm out of time.
This might sound unrelated, but it's very, very related. You have 80 years of humiliation of Islam by the West. In the Americas, we have 500 years of humiliation as Native people from the West. Yet Native Americans don't hate the United States. They will not kill themselves, blow themselves up, and kill innocents. But what makes that happen? How can we forgive 500 years of humiliation, genocide, exploitation, repression? It's continuing right now in Arizona on the border. Yet we don't have that terrorist element. I hope we never do. That's the fear that I do.
And almost, I mean, it's only a tiny minority of Muslims have that virulent hatred. Egyptians don't hate Americans. You know, the Turks don't hate Americans. Indonesians don't help Native American. But it is this very, I think there is a parallel, I agree. But it's such a difficult thing. And I want to just take an extra piece here, because I want to get it out on this virulent strain of Wahhabism and Sharia law. And much of Sharia law is non-Quranic. Okay, if there is a Quranic scholar in the village, I will defer. But within Sharia law, there are numbers of categories of crimes for which there are specific penalties. And for example, for fornication, it's punishable by stoning. Okay, for consumption of alcohol, by lashing, and by theft, by amputation of limbs. And when I was in Saudi, I saw people without limbs. I got invited to watch the weekly executions and the limbing, and of course I didn't go. I got invited to go to a stoning, okay? And in Saudi, and this, you know, forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but this really ticks me off. Our enlightened press in the United States, okay, we get all huffy when, under Sharia law, a woman gets sentenced to stoning in Iran, gets sentenced to stoning in Nigeria. Okay, Saudi Arabia stone women every week, okay? And it's wrong and it's evil.
Is it a public spectacle?
It is a public spectacle. And if you go to a stoning, you can't go as a spectator. You must participate. Okay. And another friend of mine, actually 2 months ago, was invited to go to a stoning to participate. First you go to the mosque, you pray, then you come out, you stone a woman nastily to death, it's a slow, horrible death, then you go back and pray some more. Okay. And half seriously, but half jokingly, which is even more nasty, if a man is tired of his wife, or his wife is giving him grief, he can go to the imam and say, she's been unfaithful, or she's not servicing me correctly, and give the imam some money. And the imam will issue a fatwa, and that woman will be stoned. I get really angry at this, and I get angry at people that say all religions are the same, and all people are the same, and all opinions are the same. And I had a mentor up here. I lived here a year at Holden in the 1970s. And he said that it's very good to have an open mind, but from time to time you need to close it on something. And we as a society should absolutely not be letting the Saudis, we should not be dealing with a society that is doing that. It's not just wrong legally, right? Talk about international human rights type stuff. It's evil. Call it what it is. You know, I'll call it that. Maybe that's politically incorrect. I'll call that just flat out evil. Okay. Also, in Saudi Arabia, a woman's testimony is in court is worth half of a man's. Okay, so who's going to win the fight? Okay. Also, there's under the fornication law, which is called zina, extramarital sex is is punishable by stoning to death. Okay,
with also, a woman.
With a woman, God's fault. Okay. If a woman is raped, this is true also in Iran, and if a woman is raped, she runs a high risk of being charged with zina, particularly if she becomes pregnant. And in order to prove an absence of consent, okay, a woman is required to provide 4 leading upstanding male witnesses to the rape to verify that it was not consensual. Now, in what frickin' society are 4 upstanding members of the community going to stand by when a woman is being raped? It's absolutely an impossible, it's an impossibility. And that is the law. That is Sharia law. Now, that is not the Sharia law, that is Orthodox Sharia law. It's not universal Sharia law, let's say Malaysia or Indonesia, for sure not Turkey. So Sharia law can be incredibly Orthodox, like in Saudi Arabia, or Pakistan. It can be somewhat benign, quite benign in other countries.
Kip?
Yeah.
Up here, excuse me.
to possibly parallel relevance on what Zarco said, is it possible that the 500 years of Native had strong women that were allowed more freedom than the, do you understand what I'm trying to, I'm stuttering, but the women weren't as oppressed in their own community, the Native women, as the women of the middle, Saudi and all.
I'm
actually trying to go back to where did this come from, this horrible terrorist.
This is not Quranic.
Right, I understand okay. that.
This is within the last 200 years under Wahhab and the Wahhab tradition to Wahhabism. So this is a fairly, I think there is a parallel, that Zarco brought it up.
Right.
But this is a recent tragedy in Islam that
right.
And so you have a fringe element that has all the U.S. dollar billions that we can give them to become radical. And I'll go back to, let's leave it in the set. Yeah.
It seems that as Americans, Lutherans, that the thing we can do that most directly helps these people is to cut down on our oil consumption. I don't know what else we could do really that would have a similar effect. Would you agree with that?
The shortest path to not funding both sides of the war on terror would be for us to stop importing the Middle East oil. I absolutely agree. And it's the kicker is it's dual. That's not a strategy. I'm sorry we ran out of time.